Hello, everybody, and welcome again to Back to the Future, the podcast that chats to the innovators and change makers of today who are making tomorrow happen. Yes, indeed. And making tomorrow happen with me this week are two people who are working at the highest levels of government and policy making, Scott Perugini-Kelly and Sally Washington. Scott, Sally, you're both very welcome.
Kia ora.
Good afternoon, man.
Scott, I just wanted you to talk through your full title, your Director of Foresight, Shaping Futures Community Engagement Group at the Premier and Cabinet Office in New South Wales. Now, just unpack that for me a little.
Yeah, sure, man. So in 2019, our then Secretary decided to create a Foresight team and kind of gave us a very broad mandate to try to anticipate change and kind of manage uncertainty from the centre of government. So as a central government body doing that, I guess over the years, we've learnt our craft in strategic foresight by upskilling public servants in the discipline, but we've also kind of sought out a very multidisciplinary team. So people with capabilities in data science and user experience design, anthropology, law, media, the whole mix.
Well, I'm impressed already. Sally, your title is the Executive Director of ANSOG. So let me get this right. It's the Australian and New Zealand School of Government. But are you involved in foresight or are you involved in kind of teaching and looking at bigger issues that people have to tackle?
Well, for a start, I work for the Australia-New Zealand School of Government, but I'm the Executive Director for Aotearoa New Zealand, so I'm the only one based here in New Zealand, actually. And I got interested in foresight really as part of my interest in building policy capability, so improving the way we make decisions in government. And so foresight is just another piece of the toolkit, I think, for me. And so I'm not such an expert like Scott is, but I see myself as really shaping the space for this and showing that foresight is really important in the way we advise ministers and how we make decisions in government.
Okay, good. Because that actually is one of my first questions, really looking at what I'm going to call the simplest, hardest question to answer. You know, we're talking about foresight in relation to best practices in government. But what, in effect, are we actually talking about? You know, is it better understanding of policy or is it better anticipation of what stuff could happen over the next decade? What are we looking at?
Well, for me, I think the best practice is that we need to do it. Like it's part of good decision making, and so it's about seeing it as part of good policy and good strategy. So, I think foresight in itself is nothing. It's how we use it. So, as part of government, I see it as part of the intelligence or part of evidence that goes into policy making. So, you know, we need to be able to use the insights from foresight. But for me in government, I think it's more about changing the mindsets and the capability. So having a futures mindset to think about the long-term implications of policy and having the capability even to be more like an intelligent customer of the insights from foresight, really. And I guess it's the antidote to short-termism that we often get in government.
Right. So that, I guess, Scott, leads me to you to say somebody who's working on the inside with government ministers, with policy teams, with politicians themselves. How are you seeing foresight in the field? Is it taken seriously? How does it work? Is it difficult to teach people to do stuff long-term where a lot of them are really focused on short-term solutions?
I mean, undoubtedly, we are dealing, I guess, globally with permacrisis or polycrisis environment, and that can make it hard for decision makers to focus and prioritize on key issues. I guess what foresight gives you is if you can anticipate ahead of the curve, you can buy yourself time. And for decision makers, that time for careful deliberation, unpacking certain uncertainties, and just taking the time to consult with stakeholders is invaluable. Time is a very precious commodity, and building yourself that space to make good decisions is, I think, highly valued by decision makers.
Right. So I'm getting a sense here, and I'm just going to throw this back to Sally, that, you know, we're talking with foresight quite long-term things. We're talking cross-party, I guess. That has to be consensus. But somebody said to me recently, you know, politicians are about short-term and just about their own party. So how do we get them to think like this when really they just want to get re-elected and not really have the other people involved in that process?
Well, I think we throw that at them all the time, that they're only interested in the short term, but maybe that's something we need to, as civil servants and public servants, we need to talk to them a little bit more about too, that because the future could be their legacy as well. So what's your legacy? And to think about how can we have almost an explicit bargain with them. I do some work on what's the demand side, so how we can help decision makers to be more intelligent customers of advice. And I think this thinking about foresight is part of that. And I mean, that's one side, but the other side is actually just taking it away from the politics. You know, there are governments who introduce commitment devices. So like, a report on the future, or in New Zealand, we have long-term insights briefings, which go to Parliament. So every chief executive of a government department has to produce one every 3 years.
Right. I guess, Ali, one of the questions that I was also thinking about when you were answering that is how do we effectively teach politicians the techniques and methods and processes of forecasting? Because generally, you know, it does require some skill and some specialism, and they're maybe not adept or equipped initially to embrace these kind of techniques. So do you set about teaching them the techniques before you actually give them the policy documents to study and implement, or how does it work?
I would be very surprised if there are any politicians that are able to do a foresight exercise. Right. I think that's up to advisors. So, and it's up to advisors to make explicit that they're thinking about the long term. But of course, there are some portfolios where they do that a lot more often. So you get sort of defence or transport or finance. They're much more likely to be thinking in the longer term than some of the social policy portfolios, which are much more difficult to do that. So yeah, no, I would be very surprised if they would be doing it, but I don't think they would have to do it either.
Right, we're not taking them back to school. I mean, Scott, do you find that you have to simplify, translate, dumb down, or are you having to educate people to be better when they're looking at these forecasting statements?
Certainly there's an element of translation. Like, I think foresight as a discipline can be very conceptually rich and complex, and certainly there's nothing off the shelf for us or no previous blueprint. We often very much tailor those techniques for our audience or our collaborators. I think for more senior decision makers, and that could sometimes include politicians, part of it is not presenting them the end product, but letting them experience or be immersed in scenario planning, for example, make them part of the development process, as opposed to here's some scenarios, this is what, you know, 2030 looks like. Because I think part of the exercise is getting them involved in the process, because they can actually see how it's constructed. They can see the internal logic, they can see the drivers of change, and it just becomes a much more compelling output for them.
I think that's a really important point. And I did that with a group of deputy secretaries in the New Zealand government. And actually showing by doing, I think, is really, really powerful. So getting them to think about what's going to bite us, you know, 10, 20 years if we don't start dealing with it now. And I think it's really powerful to take them to actually get them to be part of the process rather than giving them some report that's not going to mean very much to them.
Right.
So I think that's a really good way of bringing them into the dialogue.
Yeah, liking the idea that they're part of this kind of scenario or the plan, so they're enacting it out. My question is the involvement of the electorate or the voter, because a lot of the time these things are done and then they're almost imposed on slightly unknowing, potentially questioning and adverse electorates. So how do we involve people? How do we get people to help with these things, which ultimately could only take effect over the next 10, 15, 20 years?
I have quite a bit to say on this one, because I think that citizen engagement is really important in all sorts of government decision making, so not just in foresight. And something like the New Zealand long-term insights briefings, there's an obligation to consult the public once on the topics themselves and second on the draft briefings. I think it was a really bad time because it was over COVID, so that really curtailed being able to consult with people. And I think we had far too many briefings. So there were, it was sort of the usual suspects that were responding to all of them. We had 19 of them. It would be much better to have sort of a small handful of big issues. But I think you can bring people into that. And I think that's a really good way of getting the public to be future focused as well. And not just to think about the future, but actually, how do we create the future that we want?
One of the kind of curiosities we had here in the UK recently is how James Dyson, the man who gave us the centrifugal vacuum cleaner, accused the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, of scandalous neglect, pardon me, of innovation, and saying that we weren't really effective and that we didn't understand it. And he said, this is one of the other problems with the future, that we fear innovation. And I think from my point of view, innovation is a core part of getting forecasting right. So how do we make people who perhaps are not interested in science, not interested in tomorrow, not interested in change in that way, how do we make them, Scott, feel that this is something important that they need to think about in policy decision making?
I think you need to tap into people's inherent curiosity. And I think back to your reference to Tetlock, like I love the idea of prediction markets. And I love the idea that we create, I guess, an internal dynamic, even within government, of identifying people that are very good at anticipating with accuracy. And I think that's just something, I guess, senior decision makers want to understand who are the good predictors, who are the super forecasters. And I think that's important. I think the other element is bringing in collaborative intelligence into kind of government. We have, you know, collaborative intelligence on kind of where to take holidays, what meals to eat, what products to buy. But we can really start embedding in government. And this is really a key project of ours, the New South Wales Trend Atlas, where we have collated almost over 300 trends. But we are really getting to start tapping our users to start contributing, like on Wikipedia, start to putting back into the system. Don't just take out, bring your curiosity and share it with a broader network. And I think we've had great support from the OECD Observatory of Public Sector Innovation in terms of this is a model of what collaborative intelligence could look like in government.
Wow. And is that to be done by professionals, or is it open to everybody to participate?
At the moment, it's focused on government users, and we are opening it increasingly, hoping to open it up to the university sector and increasingly kind of expanding it as we go along. But it's obviously building a platform like that with that kind of concept and driver takes a long time and takes ways to perfect.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I imagine it also takes is imagination. I'm just aware of that quote. You remember when you were talking about 9/11, the great quote about it wasn't just to do with terrorism, it was to do with a gigantic failure of the imagination. And one of the things I always think we need when we're doing forecasting is the requirement to be imaginative and to push boundaries and to challenge in a different way. As somebody said, it's using the adjectives of life rather than the facts. And again, a lot of people don't seem to be equipped with the kind of imagination potentially we need to solve these big issue problems. So how do we build that into our kind of forecasting processes?
Well, not just in forecasting, but I think decision-making generally, and I love that idea of collective intelligence, but that's kind of the antithesis of the way we're brought up especially as policy advisors, to be the sort of I'm smart so I'm right kind of scenario. And I think maybe the incentives on most public servants are to be a safe pair of hands, not someone with a great imagination who's going to be disrupting and having change all the time. And you probably need a mixture of people. Like, so we do need people with imagination, but we also need the people who are just going to keep the lights on. So, I mean, I think there are various ways you can bring imagination into it, but often it's by bringing different people into the mix, so it's not just the same old all the time. And that's bringing the public, whether it's experts or people that are not the usual suspects that you want, you know, you can engage with. One of the things I really love at the moment that is really challenging in New Zealand and increasingly in Australia too is how do we look at the intelligence of our Indigenous communities, which are very much thinking about the future because they think about the people to come. So, you know, it's all about collaborative decision making and that kind of stewardship.
So how do we build that kind of thinking into policy making and, I guess, alertness? Because increasingly, they seem to be the kind of things that are bringing the world to a standstill. I mean, Scott, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's interesting because sometimes just getting subject matter experts or very senior decision makers to meditate and reflect on known unknowns, because I think culturally in government, and I think equally in business, people, you know, take pride in their role and their professional personas as I'm an expert, I know the outcomes, I'm a knowledge holder. But actually, when you go through a lot of foresight processes, you're asking them to demonstrate a degree of vulnerability. How uncertain are you about this, you know, driver of change? And that is an art I've discovered over time to make people feel comfortable to be vulnerable about what they don't know. It's a question you rarely ask very senior people. What are you unsure of? Not what do you know?
Right, which enforces, I guess, most senior people, they never really want to admit that they don't know about something. So I'm just wondering, are there particular techniques? We see a lot of scenario planning. We see a lot of use of the Delphi method, three horizon mapping. Are there particular ones that you have found yourself applying again and again, Sally, that you feel if you need to use a default method, because a lot of people listening will go, well, what are a couple of the things I can apply to my business? Were there ones that you would recommend, or are there ones rather that you would recommend?
No, I think there's not a lot of capability in this. I think we're really starting out. So for me, it's about how do we build up the capability? How do we get people to think about these things? So, there are toolkits in it, and different methods, but people understanding what to apply to what kind of challenge is really interesting. And another thing, and I think in terms of building up that capability and building up the demand for foresight, because I think it's not just the supply, it's the demand for it, is sometimes thinking about it's not just the experts, but how do we translate between the experts and the people who are actually going to be using it? So that would include politicians as well.
And Scott, are there ones that you will particularly turn to when you're speaking to ministers or working with your teams that you think, look, if I've got to get it in, this method is probably the best, easiest, quickest one to choose for my deck of foresight tools?
It's so variable, Martin. I think what we try to do in kind of collaboration workshops is use a combination. So we might use episodic futures thinking to do an exercise that emotionally opens up people to kind of different ways of thinking and then connecting them to a future, and then move them into an exercise that's really about like consequence, risk, and impact. So it's speaking to the different personas in the room that you might have, that some people might be more have higher EQ, some people might be more attached to more kind of quantitative methods. We use a range to kind of meet the different needs. I would probably note we've probably started using the three horizons technique a lot more in a service redesign context, and finding it really quite powerful to help organizations think about that second horizon, which is the crux of a change management process. So that we're finding great kind of outcomes from that. But equally, we turn to scenario planning, interviews, a whole mixed bag, but it really comes down to who are we working with and what's the level of understanding, right, and what are they trying to do?
And I guess something like scenario planning will have certain processes and approaches that allow you to apply more imaginative thinking. Well, I obviously think three horizons is probably a more familiar mathematical style model that allows particular kind of, I'm going to use the word business people, because I always find when we do three horizons, there's always men in the room who are find it easier to look at these things in threes. And I always find that my scenario planning is when you've got a really, you know, fantastically mixed group, different background diversities, who find it easier because it requires more negotiation, collaboration, conversation, debate, which I quite like, that we can talk about the future. So I'm just on that. Do we think that in government, I'm looking here, I interviewed recently Michael Mascioni, who's written a book called Reinventing Government Through Political Entrepreneurship and Exponential Innovation. And he said that one of the points that struck him, given that the book is entirely about processes and approaches and kind of different departments and divisions. He said pretty much over time, or pretty much within a year or two of them being established, they were disbanded. He said, like, it was almost great enthusiasm, great ideals up front, and then suddenly, maybe after one or two ideas, they kind of dissipated and vanished. And I'm just wondering, Sally, if you had any thoughts about that from just looking at perhaps your wider knowledge of how governments work and departments appear and disappear like Marie Celeste. I mean, why do we think innovation seems to happen in such a particular way?
Well, maybe I'll go back to what Scott was talking about in terms of methods too, because I think I saw in the long-term insights briefings here in New Zealand a lot of scenarios. But when I think about change management, I see lots of three horizons. And
right.
I think sometimes people don't really think about that as a foresight method. I think in government, generally, we're not very good at change management. And that's something that I get asked to talk about quite a lot, especially change management across government, not within organisations. So three horizons, I've started to see that come up in quite a bit of my work, which is really interesting, I think, because it's much more manageable for people. In terms of the innovation space, I think often it's because it's one person with a great idea who manages to rally people around to get a coalition of the willing so they get something happening.
Right.
And then if that person moves on, I've seen that a lot in government reform. But then again, I've seen others that have continued to. We have a co-design lab in Auckland here that's it's probably about 8 years old now, and it's really is an innovation lab. But now they're starting to help build capability across the public service. So some of them continue, some of them don't. But I think the challenge is to get these things, that these sorts of expertise in the right place. So you want them embedded enough so that they're going to have some influence, but
yep.
independent enough that they're not going to be taken over by BAU. And I think as soon as everyone realises that it's a good thing, it becomes BAU and then probably gets crushed.
Yeah, I think exactly his point is the whole notion of, you know, embedding. And I'm loving your term coalition of the willing, because he said, you know, that's one of the key areas where failure happens, is when people fail to buy in, because as it dissipates, it becomes further and further from their control points, or the point they feel will make a difference to them, they tend to disengage with it. So I feel that probably is a good reason. Scott, did you have any thoughts on why, or have you observed that when these things happen, there's an initial freshness, energy, and then suddenly over time, reality and the now takes over?
Yeah, I think to Sally's point, a lot of them just become BAU and they become mainstream. So whether it's kind of human-centered design or nudge units or behavioral insights or deliverology, I think, you know, you have these units in central government agencies, they build out hub and spoke models, people skill up and it just becomes part of the norm. And I think that in many ways is success. A big part of my mission is training up people or building their capability through projects and partnerships so they have the confidence to be great horizon scanners. They can start, you know, working with their own senior decision makers to kind of be more future ready, and that is a great outcome. But I would say a lot of the foresight teams, like globally at national levels, have been quite enduring and probably have a number of years, if not decades, on the board, which is great to see.
Good. I mean, one of the books, you probably have read it, it's called The Ministry for the Future. I always think it's like a kind of a handbook for futurologists. It's Kim Stanley Robbins's book, which really looks at how within the United Nations, under the Paris Agreement, there is a subsidiary body established that is there to represent and to advocate for the world's future generational citizens. So this notion that we have somebody now who's going to protect our future rights. Do you think that is a possibility, or is it just too fanciful for anybody to consider, this notion of protecting future businesses?
We have examples of that. The Wales Future Generations Commissioner, those sorts of people. So I think it's another kind of commitment device. But the idea of having a ministry for it is a bit scary, because I think you do need some sort of centralised expertise. And I like what Scott and his colleagues are doing in New South Wales, rather to have some kind of centralised expertise that you can share with others, and especially your trend atlas. But I think we want to build capability across too. So not everyone has to be an expert, but they have to be an intelligent customer.
So you're not an advocate of this sitting inside the United Nations?
Oh, well, maybe it would work there. We should all be thinking like that. Yeah. We should all be thinking about future generations.
Yeah, it's just when I was thinking about it and I was just kind of asking people, they really honed in on the issues that would be focused on, like, poverty, food security, climate, quantum, AI suddenly, has become a major concern. And I noticed that in business, quite a lot of businesses like Patagonia, for example, have put in place mechanisms to protect the long-term rights of the planet from short-term decisions being made by the human kind of interveners, as one of these document callers. So I'm just wondering, is there an option here for us to look at creating a system that really stops us from making short-term decisions? Do you think that would be possible, or is it just that we would never allow it because we don't have the ability to think so far into the future that we'd just panic and decide that it's not worth investing in? We just need to think about the now and not about the next.
I think we already have those, if we want to call them commitment devices. I mean, we have, like in New Zealand, we have a Fiscal Responsibility Act, for example. I think the point is, do they have impact?
Right.
And how do we use what they say? Because often you'll get a really beautiful report and it will sit on a shelf because nobody will look at it, or it isn't translated into day-to-day work.
Yeah, I think that's somebody in government here recently argued that was the point of reports. They should sit on shelves. I think they've been slightly cynical about the notion that nothing ever happens. And that's, of course, what happens is they just get left on a shelf and nobody bothers to enact them.
The other thing I was thinking about when you were talking about that, the sorts of issues that it would go to would be, intergenerational poverty, climate change, those sorts of things. Well, there are other institutions to look at those things as well. And it reminded me, actually, when my first role was in our Ministry of Women's Affairs, and we used to, anything to do with women, they'd say, oh, well, Women's Affairs can do it. And there were 20 people in that organisation. So I think that's the other thing. You don't want it to just be saying, well, that's someone else's business now.
I wonder, there's obviously some lessons from international environmental law and the concept of ecological sustainable development where, intergenerational equity is a key pillar. And I think the thing that runs alongside that often that we probably forget is the precautionary principle. And often if you think about intergenerational equity, there's both actions that creates opportunity, but if you don't want to foreclose options in the future, there's a degree of restraint that's connected to that aligns with the precautionary principle. And I think politically, sometimes that can be hard to kind of get current generations to say, you need to make a sacrifice. And I think I've seen some really interesting kind of provocations from the Institute of the Future in the US who've said, what does it look like to, have a 10-year winter if we had a geo-engineered solution whereby we experienced 10 years of winter and we solved climate change? Would we be willing to kind of make that sacrifice for future generations? And it's that notion of sacrifice that sometimes can be hard to politically kind of wrangle.
Agreed. I mean, I guess also it requires levels of understanding and levels of being able to project forward and look at the consequences of what could happen if X happens or we don't stop Y from taking place. I mean, one of the things I was going to ask you, because we're just getting towards the end of the show, is Sally, perhaps first on this, are there things that you think we should be focusing on now that politicians or policymakers are not really thinking about? I mean, obviously the one is AI, which seems to have come out of nowhere and suddenly it has wrong-footed a lot of people because it's one of the few places where everybody sees a policy is needed, but nobody is thinking or making decisions about it. But are there other things that you have hunches about or see that you feel we should be thinking about it before it becomes too late?
Well, I think we're already seeing it. So the AI, I think lots of people are thinking about AI all around the world. But I mean, the other ones like climate change, of course, intergenerational poverty. We have our Productivity Commission is working on that at the moment as a big inquiry. But I don't think any of them are unknowns. Right. I think there are those slow moving disasters. But I guess the other thing is if we catastrophize it too much, then people do just turn off. So it's a matter of saying, what can we all do to make the small changes that are going to make the big changes as we go along. But also you can't leap a chasm one step at a time. So it's another balancing question.
a thought that occurred to me when you were chatting is that a lot of people think that New Zealand as a country, as a brand, seems to have a very future-facing outlook and seems to be tackling quite a lot of those issues that are being debated across the world. But New Zealand seems to have much clearer policies. And as a kind of an external looking at New Zealand, I always think, wow, you know, you've got your kind of, you know, gender issues seem to be tackled better. Diversity issues seem to be tackled better. Its views on climate change. Is this good marketing, do you think, or is it good policy and good kind of forward thinking?
A wee bit, but from the inside, you can always be more critical, I think. So I find that when I go to any other system, I'm quite proud about New Zealand. And when I'm inside New Zealand, I'm quite critical. So especially gender, working with our Māori population, Indigenous issues, those sorts of things. I think we are further ahead, but it's all relative, so we're not that far ahead. The same with climate change, and I don't think we're way ahead. But I think maybe because we're so small and we've got a very simple system of government too, that it makes things change can be easier.
Right.
And everybody seems to know each other is another bonus.
Right. So it's like Ireland where I come from. It's a big family in a small country, or a big country in a small family, depending on how you look at it. But I'm just wondering, Scott, on your side, what are the things that you feel? Because I know when I visit Australia quite a lot, there are still massive debates about climate change, massive debates about, you know, Indigenous populations, debates between, you know, people who live in the country and those who live on maritime cities. And I always feel that Australia is still very much coming to terms with different legacies and different heritage points or pain points. But what do you think are the things that really you have to think about now before potentially it becomes too late to make changes?
I think every country needs to think about this, but like how I'd think about this in an Australian context of what is the future of value creation? And this was very much inspired by a Policy Horizons Canada report about the future of value. And for me, it's how do we kind of create value, but whether that's social, economic, or environmental value into the future? And part of that, you know, that is a very large umbrella of kind of lines of inquiry, but it could, for example, include like, what are the states under which we produce work? And, you know, obviously the Future Laboratories work on future work states. Like, what are the preconditions for us to create things that we sell in markets, or that, you know, social capital that we have? Like, how do we create value in the future? And I'm absolutely perplexed and constantly kind of thinking about this question, because I think it's a nice vehicle to start asking those questions from a national level. How does Australia create value in kind of a global economy and a global geopolitical environment?
Well, because I think those things really come both to the actuality of you know, how we define value, and I guess also how we perceive value. Because I would argue, you know, having kind of visited both countries, you know, where you're based now, I always think the perception of value from New Zealand and Australia is probably greater than in reality is. So there's a brand equity that sits over and above the value, and then within that is the reality of that value. And I always think that's the getting the balance right, isn't it? This is where politicians tend to see the negative about the country, the jurisdiction, where people visiting or looking in at it tend to see it as a positive. And I always think if you can get those things to match, it becomes more useful in changing or elevating debates.
I think we also have to think about value for who. And we're moving away from thinking that that growth is good, and to think about, so New Zealand's got it, just this week we're coming up to another wellbeing budget. So thinking about value for different people and distributed value as well. And even as we invest, are we, especially in the social areas, are we investing to reduce a future liability, or are we investing to grow a future asset? And, you know, those sorts of questions in education and health and those kind of portfolio areas, I think, are really, really important.
You know, sudden degrowth is a term that has been used in New Zealand and in Ireland and countries where we're recognizing that value isn't about increased energy or et cetera, et cetera. It's about reducing things in a fairly manageable way. And the Australian chap was going, well, no, it's the opposite, it's about expanding, because one still has a great amount to expand into and the other is looking at alleged finance resources. So I do think even terms like where we talk about value, and degrowth. Degrowth is seen in some countries as a negative, but actually it's now increasingly seen as part of a values positive system. So I do think, to our points earlier about having the debates about the future and talking about them and planning them, probably allow us to have those conversations that really let us define how we're looking at these notions that are representative of tomorrow. I was just wondering, on our last few minutes, is there anything particularly you think that we really must solve before it's too late? I've given you AI, we've talked about food, talked about energy growth. Anything else that you finally would say, listen, I think we need to tackle this now, otherwise we will not be having this conversation next year, perhaps?
It's not an issue, it's not a what, it's a how. And I think the how is, how do we improve the way we make decisions that include a lot more voices that think about what we've tried in the past and what might be coming in the future, so that we think about that hindsight, foresight, insight, deep insight about what the way people live their lives and the way government affects them. So for me, it's about improving the how and the way we make decisions.
The how. Scott, any final comments on that?
Listen, always thinking about trust in government and social cohesion. And I think there was some interesting insights from the Edelman 2023 Trust Index. And it was this strange, interesting acknowledgement that countries that tend to be a bit more authoritarian can also create greater confidence for citizens in their future path trajectory. And that's an interesting kind of fact, because I think a lot of citizens around the world are wanting greater stewardship and custodian of futures and a clearer path forward in a period of quite substantial technological and social change. And I think if governments and businesses and institutions and civil society can't start to fill that need from citizens around custodianship of the future, I think it will continue downwards in terms of trust in government, which we don't want.
Yeah, it's an interesting, in fact, one of our future podcasts, so I may actually come back to you with this, we're just looking at trust and how you build trust in tomorrow, given that tomorrow hasn't actually happened. So what are the mechanisms we need to put in place to ensure that we will trust either those institutions, the people managing them, or the countries and the brands that will represent the future itself. So how do we go about doing that? But that is all we have time for this week. You've been listening to Scott Perenguini-Kelly, Sally Washington, and myself, Martin Raymond. You will find lots of links that accompany the podcast. We'll also, Sally, I'm going to include some of your papers. Scott, any public work that we can see without ministers leaning over your shoulder and complaining, we'll have them up as well. Thank you all for listening. So until next time, as always, I'm challenging you to keep looking, keep listening, keep learning, and of course, keep asking what's new and what's next. Thank you.
Thanks, man.